Yeah, good morning. I have the difficult task to be the third one on the morning panel, so I'll try to keep you awake. Tom, could you remind me when I have 10 minutes left so I can sort of speed it up then, because I might have brought a little bit too much material. So thanks first also for a great conference organization. And to start with, I'd like to say some words about the research background to this contribution. For some years, I was busy with a research project on Soviet urbanism after 1955, part of which was about exploring conduits of knowledge diffusion and the makeover of the institutional landscape of planning, design, and research through which architectural and planning knowledge was formed and mediated. And it was in this context that I found it also quite remarkable how in the middle of this fundamental makeover of Soviet planning and design organizations, at the turn to the 60s, the USSR was also really keen to export its architectural and urban planning expertise globally. So I began to look a bit closer into Soviet technical cooperation and institution building abroad, focusing on one case initially, the urban planning and construction projects in the Afghan capital Kabul in the 1960s. One key object realized in these import-export relations was a polytechnical institute in Kabul, designed and built by Soviet organizations as a gift to Afghanistan, which part of which you see here on this title slide. I'm grateful to Tom for the kind invitation to pick up the thread and further explore Soviet campus exports in a broader geographic perspective as a chapter in this project context. And it is an assemblage still in progress. And I'd like to mention that also simultaneously, I'm teaching and learning also a lot from a seminar on campus import-export at the Institute for Architecture of TU Berlin. Some of the students are around also at this conference, and I really look forward to the student case studies on mid-20th century university campus development in international perspective, and also present-day global education export. My presentation today will touch on USSR initiatives to build higher education institutes, mostly polytechnics, in very diverse countries such as Afghanistan, Guinea, or Vietnam. It will focus mostly on the polytechnic in Kabul and its context of broader technical cooperation and exchange, because time is limited, and just offer some glimpses on others. And my aim is really to set the construction of these higher education facilities and the actual physical spaces created there in connection to institution building for spatial planning and construction. That is, with the institutionalization of the production of space in a Lefebvrean sense, with multiple impacts and repercussions for urbanization. In the past few years, research and reflection on the global dimension of socialism has proliferated wildly. And I'm indebted to quite a long exchange with my colleague Lukas Stanek, whose great book has just been published. Also, there's been a lot of reflection going on in art exhibition, culture projects, and the Red Africa cover is just a placeholder for many things that have been going on in recent years. And my work is situated, of course, in this larger context and also within research debates on transnational planning that have been going on for quite a while, initiated by scholars like Stephen Ward or Anthony King, introducing categorizations such as the export versus the import of architecture and planning approaches, or differentiating authoritarian or contested impositions on the one hand versus deliberate borrowings. And in my work, while seeking to stay attentive to the specific historic situations and negotiations, clearly there are also limitations to my perspective, which is taken a primary entry point from Soviet archives, architecture, journals, magazines, and it's also an important question how to re-evaluate, and present the highly charged visual materials that you find, and some of it you will see during this presentation. Let me begin in the Soviet Union. In the early 1970s, there were around 800 higher, that is, tertiary education facilities in the Soviet Union, among them 50 universities and 250 technical and polytechnical institutes. Of the Soviet population of well above 200 million, 5 million were students in these institutions, more than half in evening or distance programs. The planning and design for higher education was highly centralized. Most of it was done by the GIPRAVUS, the State Institute for Design of Higher Learning Institution, an institute with 1,300 employees in different regional branches across the Union. The work of this institution included also the definition of future student requirements and capacities in relation to economic regional specialization. In 1967, design standards were formulated and published by this institute with precise calculations of spaces and cost parameters. There's just some not very well visible campus projects of this time. Principally, they would be divided in three zones of buildings for learning. Usually a common building for the beginner's years, then specialized faculty buildings for different technical specializations, and some common facilities. There would be sports facilities, and there would be student housing on campus. So the whole campus was a self-sufficient environment for students of sorts, isolated learning environment detached from the urban context. Maybe the location would also be related to relevant production or research facilities. And Dina Dorothea Falbe also mentioned polytechnic education. It was seen as a cornerstone of communist education already at school age, since the time of Lenin and Nadezhda Krupskaya, with the agenda to teach scientific foundations of contemporary production, that is, natural sciences and engineering in theory and practice. There was a proclaimed focus on hands-on experience and experimentation, on learning by doing, and also on bringing already pupils close to the realities of production, which could also mean to deploy them as a labor resource at times, or actually frequently. And naturally, it was very important that production relations were studied in a social context according to Marxist-Leninist principles. Out of the 62 polytechnical institutes in the USSR in 1975, so there were, out of the 250 I mentioned earlier, there were lots of specialized technical institutes. The polytechnical ones covered a wider range. And nearly half were only founded after 1955. So there's a huge expansion of education going on at this point in time, also in the USSR. And if I'm right, or Tom, you confirmed this amply yesterday, the project Education Shock derives its title partly from the notion of the Sputnik shock, that is, the West awakening to Soviet or Eastern impressive achievements in the field of technology and engineering. But in parallel to dealing out this Sputnik shock, the Soviet leadership was also, since Khrushchev, embarking on what contemporaries saw as a great global charm offensive since 1955. While the world map was remade country by country, achieving independence from colonialism, the Soviet government offered recognition and political alliance to many emerging new states. It seems a bit presumptuous that this independence movement was subsumed in this map, for example, to the chronology or the jubilee of the October Revolution, as if that was the only course in history. But still, there were numerous agreements of economic and cultural cooperation fleshed out through a broad spectrum of technical assistance on the financial base of attractive credits, barter agreements, or denominated as outright gifts. And such gifts from the Soviet Union could be hospitals, agricultural machinery, sports stadiums, palaces of culture, or, to come to the main subject here, education facilities, from primary to vocational schools of all sorts and higher education. It came in the form of scholarships or the campus exports. And that the pedagogy and the embrace might have felt a little stiff and penetrant at times, seems to be conveyed probably unwillingly in these 1961 photos of a student at the Moscow University of People's Friendship, and in the context of the same Soviet magazine, two women identified as study friends. Also at Druzhba Narodov, it feels like, well, there's something really not quite right here. So let me move to the case of the Polytechnical Institute established as a Soviet gift in Afghanistan. Built between 1963 and 69, it was only one element within a much larger bundle of Soviet technical assistance projects, agreements, and grants. Projects such as irrigation dams, industrial plants, schools, and highways promised economic and technical progress. Here's a map published in the Soviet Union of all the different projects that were underway in the first half of the 60s. Here you see some of the architectures that were built along the highways that were constructed through the countries. These projects often complemented projects by other donor countries, and agree with many historians reading that Soviet assistance to Afghanistan in the 1960s must still be read as an open-ended modernization endeavor in the context of peaceful competition or competitive coexistence at the time. And this, of course, should not deny that it was a very heavy-handed paternalism of a development idea involved here, which ultimately ended in violence and war and contributed to justifying this complicated and brutal war that was to ensue at the end of the 70s. Well, in the early 60s, Soviet architects drafted a general plan for Kabul in exchange with local and international planners. They realized modern micro-rayon housing districts with the respective social infrastructure and engineering networks, specifically engineered for these districts. So they would propose similar modernization tools as French or West German building companies at the same time: prefabricated concrete housing, sanitation, electrification. But with the export of a plan for prefab building components for these apartment blocks, the matching industrial technology was also handed over to the Afghan government in the same parcel, financed through one of many Soviet loans. This also set an example for state-financed approaches to housing. The Soviet projects embodied diffusion of knowledge and technology on many levels. Thousands of Afghan staff were trained by and worked with Soviet engineers and foremen. Soviet experts undertook geological, social, and economic surveys. The general plan endowed representation to a specific model of urban development and governance, and thus Soviet technical assistance would have really multiple and significant repercussions for the production of space and urbanization. However, it's also very crucial to emphasize the agency of diverse Afghan stakeholders in commissioning and choosing from the options on offer by different international donor countries who try to kind of outdo each other. So that there's clearly, this must be seen as an import or borrowing rather than an imposition at this point in time. One example would be that the Afghan clients forced the Soviet engineers to adapt the prefab building component plant to put out construction elements for building not only the four-story standard apartment blocks, but also a series of townhouses with 4 to 11 rooms for private purchase. So clearly some nice, elite, modern housing, and it was really difficult for the Soviet side to overcome the technical restrictions of their own technology to manage to do this, but they ultimately did. Unfortunately, we don't have many traces of what actually was built with these. So, coming to the Soviet Polytechnical Institute. Also, this initiative was not the first development aid project for higher education in Afghanistan in this time of competitive coexistence. In 1956, Kabul University engineering faculty had been found with US aid money in collaboration with American institutions, where all teaching was offered in English and some access to US scholarships was available. This established the first higher education program for construction and architecture in the country. And this slide shows the new campus for Kabul University, which was built with US assistance in 1964 by a German Hochtief. But increasing numbers of Afghans choose also to study in the Soviet Union in the 50s and 60s. And following on Khrushchev's charming promise of giving Afghan people a polytechnic as a gift, it was designed by a Gipravus architect team headed by Pavel Stinyushin, who had already led or participated in designs of a technological institute in Rangoon, Burma, in 58, and the Hanoi Polytechnic in the early 60s. In 1963, Leonid Brezhnev laid the foundation stone for the campus in Kabul. The satellite view is from 2014, and you see that some of the areas have later been built up with other quite important buildings, for example, the Loya Jirga tents, where very important political negotiations took place during the 2010s. So this is a bit changed. It doesn't clearly represent the original situation. The campus is characterized by straightforward late Soviet modern architectural language. We can speak 3 hours about this debate, but I don't want to. Its centerpieces are a main assembly and sports hall with a huge mosaic facade in natural stone set in the axis of a main promenade along water basins and fully glazed walls. Also, please note the display of Russian experts, which is still in use today by Russian political leaders. This large round refectory building with fully glazed walls. And there was also professors and student housing blocks on campus constructed in prefab concrete elements, their facades structured by loggias and brisolet elements in simple geometric patterns. Also, teaching equipment, labs, and a large library. So essentially all the know-how and staff also needed to run a higher learning institution was supplied by Soviet organizations. It followed the model of polytechnic education in the USSR, initially minus the Marxist-Leninist part, offering degrees in engineering, civil industry and road construction and planning, and geology, natural resources, surveying and instruction. As most professors came from the USSR, translation services and intensive Russian language training were set up. In short, really a complete institutional ready-made was exported and set up to function in this foreign context. In 1970-71, there were 691 students, among them 6 women, enrolled in the polytechnic, about 1/10 of the total number of university-level students in the country at this time. And here, Afghan upper and middle class youth mostly were trained as a technical elite to realize the modernization of their home country according to global standards, specifically versed in Soviet approaches to development. The skills and knowledge brokered here would be practically applied in planning and engineering, for example, in the Central Authority for Housing and Town Planning, which had been newly founded in the mid-60s, as an effort founded also by the United Nations and supported by other donor countries, and thus contributed to physical and institutional transformation of the country at large. And simultaneously, the polytechnic became an important space of political debate and conflict in the city and the country as a whole, as the universities in Kabul in general. After the Tsar Revolution in 1978, the polytechnic was given a monopoly in engineering education, and the US-supported Kabul University engineering department was phased out. In 1980, an architecture program was launched at the Polytechnic as well, cooperating with the Moscow Architecture Institute. And at this time, while conflicts over development pathways, domestic and international power struggles had already turned into a war between different factions with Red Army intervention at this point in time, there are some traces that a few architecture scholars and students from Moscow and Kabul were seeking sort of reconciliatory approaches to modernization of the built environment here. For example, sustainable housing better adapted to culture and climate. Or, for example, writing in the 1980s, Soviet architecture researcher Vladimir Kartsev evaluated the old towns of Afghanistan as, I quote, ideally organized environments, end of quote, and called for their integration, or the integration of traditional spatial organization principles into urban modernization projects. And yeah, I think I'll just move on to, last but not least, the Kabul Polytechnic was implicated in the production of an institutional space of quite another scale and dimension. Beyond bilateral relations with education and planning institutions in Moscow, it was also part of a global institutional topography centered on Moscow. I'd like to point just briefly to the institutionalization of international expert meetings of urban planners, which would assign and establish positions of donors and recipients of development know-how and funding, like this series of UN seminars on planning and development of towns, which also happened in Moscow, organized by Soviet institutions. And also, I already briefly mentioned the University of People's Friendship, about which a lot of research has been done recently, including the history of international students in Soviet universities. And at the University of People's Friendship, also urban planning and architecture was taught, for example, by Anatoly Rimsha, one of the Soviet authors of the Kabul General Plan of 1964, who then authored a Soviet version, one could say, of a tropical architecture and urbanism handbook, passing on this planning experience to be traded to other countries. Yeah. Some short portraits of other polytechnical institutes designed by Kipravu's teams in the late 50s and 60s. The first tertiary education complex designed by Kipravu's for humid, tropical climate conditions was the Technological Institute of Rangoon in Burma. The project was officially presented as a gift of the Soviet people on Khrushchev's visit to the country in 1958 and realized by 1961. But in contrast to Kabul, here it was not about the export of an entire institution, but here an already existing engineering college of Rangoon University moved here from a building that had just been finished in 56 and designed by UK architect Raglan Squire. So you have this kind of, another country employing these different donations, let's say, or contributions from international competing donors. And drawing on this experience, soon after the Kipravus, including Stinyushin, designed the Hanoi Polytechnical Institute for 2,400 students. This was one of the first major buildings constructed with Soviet Union technical assistance in Vietnam to tackle the problem of training a specialized national workforce for a modernizing economy. Because in Vietnam, French colonial education policy and the war before already resulted in a lack of professionals and technicians. This complex was erected by Vietnamese construction organizations with technical assistance and project management by Soviet specialists. And it also introduced Vietnamese workers to new construction methods, including on-site concrete slab fabrication, because there was not yet any industrial production of building components in the country. And here, is a very different painful history of war involved, because after the official opening in November 65, classes had hardly begun when the building was evacuated for US bombing, and the war seriously affected teaching like everything else in the country until 1973. I think I've got like 2 minutes? Five, okay. Historian William Logan evaluates the effort to provide higher educational opportunities to Vietnamese men and women as, I quote, one of the most beneficial elements of Soviet influence to Vietnam. And for example, some of the first students of the planning department at Hanoi Polytechnical University were involved in preparations of the first comprehensive master plan for Hanoi in the early 60s, which was elaborated under the with the Soviet architect in association with Vietnamese architects. And this plan was also not implemented due to the war, but created an important model for later plans. The importance of the, as she puts it, technological worlding of Vietnamese cities through these kind of planning exercises, and specifically also the mass housing projects that became very important after the mid 70s, after the end of the war with the United States, and has been very perceptively pointed out also by urban ethnographer Christina Schwenkel, who has presented some excellent studies on these neighborhoods and how also the contribution of the GDR and Soviet experts is now kind of continuing to impact the perception of urbanity, let's say. Also, French colonies in Africa achieving independence were lacking professionals and higher education facilities to train them. So Soviet projects would be gladly accepted, even among very complicated political maneuvers between US, UK, Soviet, Chinese rivaling factions, and for example, in Conakry, Guinea. Here, a polytechnic institute was built with Soviet assistance between 1961 and 65, which was the country's first higher education facility for construction, engineering, geology, and agronomy for 1,600 students. The British ambassador at the time of building was observing it with quite condescending comments that there wouldn't be not more than 50 Guineans qualified to even attend this this institution, which speaks of the kind of very different perspective, maybe, that this Soviet grandiose gestures on the one hand and this condescendence on the other would conflict. But the question to what extent such institutions would need real needs in higher and professional education also resurfaces in some of the other cases, for example, in Ethiopia. So it wasn't, and in Afghanistan as well, so this matching between the education offered here and what kind of things graduates would do afterwards is not so easy to solve. And I mean, here it's also impossible not to speak quite briefly about the wall mosaics that were so characteristic of these architectures also in the Soviet Union at the time. They were designed by Moscow-based architects Sergei Mikheyev and Vladimir Nestorov. They show the main building on the left side, a kind of African Prometheus, a powerful or strong young African, as they wrote, breaking the chains of colonialism and bearing the torch of freedom and progress. And it's still featured prominently on the university's website, this mosaic, so it seems not to be completely discarded as an image and as an art form. And the library building on the right side has a wall mosaic of 36 meters width on the theme of the rich natural resources of the country, representing a Guinean girl with diamond and gold in her palms. Let me jump to something like a summary or conclusion. The Soviet institution building, as discussed in this paper, must be seen as one component within various entangled strategies and processes of multilateral and bilateral development cooperation, which was enlisted by independent countries to overcome the lack of educational facilities. All these projects produced individual architectural landmarks and contributed to specific institutionalization processes in the respective cities and countries. In total, they formed something like a global network of higher education institutions modeled on Soviet practice and expertise. And as such, they also embodied an institutional topography of center and periphery that aspired to offer alternatives to established post-colonial or colonial institutional ties within a socialist political framework. But still, I'm really not quite close to the answer yet. Is it really about the center-periphery relations, or should we rather, or should I, let's say, also for this project, should we rather work with an assemblage of different layered histories that are not focusing on one center so much, with some common threads in the shape of buildings, architecture, learning, bilateral relations? So this is some of the main threads that could play a role in these layered histories. The question of competitive coexistence, of concurrence and complementation, of improvised exchanges and adaptations, and also of how to write in the antagonisms and the violence that surrounds these projects. Another layer would be the aspirations versus actualizations that can be traced also in the representational qualities of the architecture and institutions. And yes, finally, what kind of global topography of institutional relations is there, what kind of mobilities and what kind of communities would be established through these institutions. Yeah, thanks.